all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today. We've got some great programs for you. I think you'll find very interesting. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or by going to veteransradio.net, where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday, so you can get a new story, a new interview, something you didn't know before by going to veteransradio.net. And before we get started, we want to thank our sponsors. First up, we want to thank National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. It was established to certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses. You'll find out how they can help your business by going to NVBDC.org. We also want to thank Eisenhower Center. It's a brain injury recovery center. Learn more about EisenhowerCenter.com. They're located in Michigan and in Florida. We want to thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans fights for veterans' disability rights all across the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or on the web at LegalHelpForVeterans.com. We want to thank VetBiz Central, which is part of the U.S. Small Business Association, VBOC, Vet Business Outreach Centers. VetBiz Central covers Michigan, Indiana, and Ohio, and can be reached at VetBizCentral.org. Let's move on to our programs. We're going to hear from Army veteran Colonel Cliff Worthy, what it was like to be an African-American at West Point in the 40s in his career in through the 60s and early 70s. And then we're going to hear from Navy veteran Erica Robertson of what her experiences were like to get off the streets of Detroit and create a new opportunity for herself through military service. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today U.S. Army Colonel Clifford Worthy, retired. Cliff Worthy, or Colonel Worthy, has written a book called The Black Knight, An African-American Family's Journey from West Point, A Life of Duty, Honor, and Country. Colonel, we're glad to have you on Veterans Radio this morning.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Well, we're going to talk about a unique slice of time in military history. You went to West Point in 1949, graduated in 1953, and continued to serve in the active duty Army until 1976. So we've got a lot of ground to cover.
Yeah, but for the record, I don't regret a minute of it. It was just a great, great experience. I admire West Point and its principles I had just a great career. Happy to be able to share that with you.
Well, you know, and before we start into that, let me back up because everybody's story is really about their family story. And your family moved from Georgia up to the Detroit, Michigan area when Henry Ford started paying $5 a day to people to work on the assembly lines. And that brought your family north, and that's a pretty common story for a lot of Southerners who moved up to the Midwest and particularly Detroit. And you found your way to what now is called Wayne State University, at the time was Wayne University, and we're kind of headed in a pre-med direction. I think the extended family wanted a doctor, and you were kind of the guy.
Exactly right. I was an only child, but I had a huge extended family. A couple of years ago, I counted my cousins, and there were 51 of them that I could recall. So you can see that it was a big family, and And they all wanted to have a family doctor. I was 16 years old when I graduated from high school, and they had already decided that I was going to be the family doctor, not just the immediate family, but the extended family doctor.
Certainly,
so
certainly.
Went to Wayne, as you say. It was Wayne that time. It became Wayne State later on. But clearly, with my family status, there was little or no chance of my ever going to med school, or getting into going. And so that's how I ultimately became got to West Point.
Wait a minute. You're skipping over a few things here, Colonel.
Okay.
I've had the opportunity to read the book and do some studying, and this wonderful gentleman who's 92 years old now, and there's a lot of wisdom that your book has that comes out of your life that I don't want people to skip over, and that is just the role that chance sometimes takes in one's life. You had no idea what West Point was about it wasn't until 1948 that President Truman's executive order desegregated the military. But it was this chance opportunity in 1946 where you bumped into somebody, and West Point kind of got put on the map for you. Took a few years to get there. But tell us about how chance just played into a role here.
Well, that's a good word, chance, because it was like an opportunity that was thrust upon me. I had no military background whatsoever. And so I met this young man who had been to West Point but didn't make it through. And I was at the main old main building there, at the administration building at Wayne at the time. And we talked. I recognized him because he had his uniform on. And so we talked, and I told him my background. And after realizing that he realized that my chances of going to medical school were pretty slim, he says, "Why don't you apply for an appointment to West Point?" Well, before that minute, that second, I had never given West Point a thought. The only thing I knew about West Point was, at that time, the movies. Went to the movies. It was sort of always the cadets marching as an introduction to the movie of the night. And so that was my experience, and that's how it all got started.
And it takes another sort of chance meeting, but maybe chance isn't the right word, but determination.
Hello?
Yes. Colonel, are you there?
The volume went down.
Okay. Yeah, let me work on that. We'll come back and edit that out. Not a problem. So, Colonel, not only was this chance meeting with this former cadet, but you had to get an appointment to West Point. And at that time, that wasn't easy for a black man to get. It was really, West Point was sort of beyond the dream of any black family. How did you get the appointment?
Well, that's how it got started. Meeting this young man who had literally flunked out of West Point, and suggested I could write to my congressman, which I did, not expecting ever to hear back from the congressman. 3-cent stamp back in those days. So I sent a request to him, and not expecting to hear back. About 3 weeks later, I got a response back from him saying, "Send me your grades and talk to a couple of local politicians, and we'll go from there," which shocked me and my family as well. But anyway, I did that expecting not to hear back, but I did, and that was the beginning of the process. Now, I didn't get into West Point in 1946. But that was how it got started, and I didn't actually get into it until 1949. But due to Congressman Dingell's persistence, I ultimately got into West Point. Maybe I left out some details you'd like to hear about before I got there.
No, I just want to remind some people, because they've probably forgot this history, and we're talking about John Dingell Sr., John Dingell Jr., who passed away recently. This is his father, and... another lesson I think your life shows us right there, Colonel, is you sort of don't get up. You don't give up. You might get rejected once, but you stayed on the path to get in 1949.
That's exactly right. And I owe a lot of credit to Congressman Dingell, who just had decided he was going to get me into West Point no matter what. And and so as a result, it actually happened in 1949. And thank God for him, for his efforts. I never met him. I never saw him. We talked. In fact, we never talked. Just a mail, through the mail, until we got the ball rolling, and then I was able to meet the requirements I had to meet.
And you get into West Point, and again, this is 1949. There's a lot of discrimination occurring in the country. But you write that you never felt discriminated at West Point except in the housing area. Talk to us a little bit about how they handled housing.
Okay, well, before 1948, our military was not integrated. It was segregated. There were black units and there were white units. And even the black units were commanded by white officers. But when President Truman issued the edict in 1948, that changed everything there. Well, there was some resistance on the part of the military, but it happened. West Point apparently got it. So in 1949, I entered West Point, and as a result of that, for four years, I never had any instance that I can recall. And I'm sure that something maybe I've forgotten where I have had a problem because of my race as black. Except for, and it wasn't a problem, but that's just the way it was. Policy was back in those days. Black cadets roomed together, no matter what their height was. Well, they had assigned cadets to companies based on their height for parade purposes, make sure everybody looked nice, you know. But in our case, the black cadets roomed together, and it just so happened that one of my roommates was about 4 inches shorter than the other two of us. And, of course, which created some problems for him, and I won't go into the details there, but that's how it all happened. We 4 years there, people have asked me about that, basically the same question about what racial concerns, what was the problem there. To my memory, I don't know of anything that I can point to. As a matter of fact, the reverse is true as far as I'm concerned. I became the captain of the squash team, and I was on the tennis team, and so I felt that I was well treated. Now I'm not so naive that I don't think that there were instances where the race thing showed up, but I just can't recall any right now.
Well, and again, it may not have been to your face. It may have been behind you to the back. But I did want to talk about squash and tennis. As a kid who picked up tennis myself on the public courts around Metro Detroit, I was fascinated early to learn that you turned to tennis in high school. But it kind of followed you through life. It allowed you at West Point, because you were a racket sport guy, right? You played tennis. You had never played squash.
Right.
But it allowed you to fit in with a different group of people. Ultimately, you were the first black captain of a sports team at West Point on the squash squad.
That's correct.
And you played tennis kind of all over the world in some interesting places. But isn't that one of those things where it's just, you have to allow yourself to enjoy what you're doing and let that lead you in new directions?
Absolutely. Just to talk a little bit more about the tennis situation, I just happened one day to walk past the tennis court watching the team practice, and I looked at that and I said, well, I can play about as well as that. So I just walked up to the coach and introduced myself. And tried out and made the team. With squash, I had never played before, and I didn't know anything about the game, but I was a racket guy, and So I was on the squash team, and then the next year I was the captain of the squash team. So that's my history, my athletic history at West Point.
Well, and let me put this in context to our veteran radio listeners. We're talking to Colonel Clifford Worthy, retired U.S. Army officer. He's talking about his time at West Point, and we're going to turn to his military career here shortly. But he's playing tennis and squash at West Point. There isn't a professional black tennis player until Althea Gibson in the mid-1950s. And there's not a professional male tennis player until Arthur Ashe in the mid-1960s. So you kind of have to put into context this getting on the team in 1949 or 1950. You're really at the vanguard of those sports for African Americans, aren't you?
Yes, that's right. As a matter of fact, after my squash time at West, during my squash time at West Point, I was ranked probably number 23 based on a ranking system among collegiate squash players, and so I had a very successful squash career at West Point. And of course, you mentioned the tennis part of it, but it was, we played most of the teams that were on the Ivy League circuit, and they were all very good squash and tennis players because they were raised playing squash and tennis. And so it was, that was quite an experience, and I think it made my time at West Point a lot more bearable.
And that's true today. The military academies all encourage extracurricular activities. They encourage one or two sports for all of their cadets, in part for building collegiality, in part for making that difficult environment more tolerable. And it's interesting to see that this went, you know, I didn't realize that was sort of a philosophy for decades and decades in front of my own awareness of it.
That's true.
Let me move to, I want to mention this, and I want to move to your career. I want to mention that you also had the typical West Point experience of marrying your beloved fiancé, then wife Lillian, at West Point, right at the time of graduation, and had the traditional cross swords coming out of the chapel. I mean, this was just unfathomable to probably your family back in Detroit just a few years earlier, that you would have arrived at that point. It had to be amazing to everybody.
It was a major turn of events. I met Lillian the year before I entered West Point, and for the 4 years that I was there, of course, we dated, and as much as you can at being at West Point. And the day after graduation, we were married at the cadet chapel, and probably the first black couple married at the chapel with sabers, bearers, and all of the pomp and ceremony that goes with it. And it's interesting that you brought that up, because 20 other cadets were married that same day at the same chapel. So one would wonder, how could that be done? Well, they were so disciplined and organized in it that we had about 20 minutes or so of time, Lillian and I, to have just a typical wedding. And then we would come outside, and as soon as had finished our taking pictures and done the usual things, another couple would go into the chapel and be married. And yes, my family from Detroit and other places came to West Point for the ceremony, and it was the first time they'd ever, actually most of them had ever been out of Georgia or Detroit, and they were, you know, of course that was like a fish out of water, but there was quite an event. I'll never forget it.
Well, it had to be a very proud moment for the family, and now I want to turn to the post West Point time, because
okay.
it is here out in, I guess I'll call it the real world, that assignments start taking you places, and you particularly off base run into issues of segregation and comments of being called boy or told to go to the back door for food, and this is. I suppose in hindsight, not surprising. Probably at the time it was happening, it was at times both surprising and expected. But let me put this in context for our veteran radio listeners, Colonel Worthy. You had, and I don't have the number right, I'm going to list off some of the places, but you had, what, 20-some assignments over your career and moves?
That's probably true. I never kind of counted them, but that's about right. But there are many. I can give you a quick summary of that if you'd like.
Please do. I think, again, it will help people understand what military service is like and sort of how you move across the country to do it.
Well, that was the problem. West Point was no problem, but traveling was a big problem for black cadets and officers. When you went from one assignment to another, you had to really plan your trip and find do some research on where you could go to, where you could stay when you had to stay, and where you could eat and where you had to eat, and those kinds of things. You just couldn't stop at a motel because you just liked the looks of it. You had to get some advance war warnings. So in one case I mentioned in the book, in a little town called Clayton, New Mexico, I went to the gas station there and had to ask for some gas and asked for a place that where I could eat. And my wife and I were together. We made the mistake of leaving our New York license plate on our car. But anyway, he told us to go to this restaurant. We were thinking, well, if he said that, you know, we could go, he was looking at us, he could see that we were black, I guess it's okay. So we went to the place. And as we got to the front of the building, you could see inside through the glass windows there. And everybody was having a great time, jolly time, and everybody enjoying their food and everything. I walked in, and the place went dead silent. I mean, you could hear a pin drop. Even the fellow that was cleaning the place, the black fellow that was cleaning up the place, he stopped and froze. And the person, the lady that was attending, she was just absolutely furious that I would even dare come in there to order some food. And she made some negative and racial comments about coming in the back door and all of that. So, but her boss, the manager, I assume, I guess he felt it didn't want to start anything, so he said, go ahead and give him what he wants. So she threw the food at me, a couple of hamburgers. And as we walked out, we could hear the chair scrubbing the floor. So every man in the restaurant got up, and we walked out the door, and they were gathering, you could tell. And I got into a car, and I didn't know what to expect, because in a situation like that, the sheriff, if there was one, he probably would be leading the pack that's behind me there. But anyway, we got in the car and we drove off, and all at least about 10 or 12 pickup trucks were following us down the road. And of course, we didn't know what was going to happen to us, but we got close to the Colorado border, somewhere along that way, where we turned off, and then they turned around and went back. But that was the kind of experiences we had at that time. Same was accommodations were the same way. So yes, that was not very enjoyable.
Well, and again, because the way the military moves folks around, and this is common today, but the traveling is different. There are planes for most folks, and not that kind of discrimination at public accommodations. But you went to Colorado, you went to Fort Knox in Kentucky, you went to Fort Sill in Oklahoma, you went off to Germany, you came back to Oklahoma, you got sent off to University of Arizona, you go off to the Pentagon. I mean, you have a lot of moves in this 23-year career.
Yeah, I can. Well, went to camp. It was Camp Carson at that time. But there for a while, then to Fort Knox, and then from Fort Knox I went to jump school, airborne school. Went from there to Fort Meade, Maryland, and we joined I was assigned to the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment, and we were in ready to ship out to go to Germany, they had a program called Gyroscope that got started back in those days, where we would move from the U.S. to Germany, taking new equipment, bringing our families right along with us, and then our counterpart in Germany would move to the U.S. and we would leave their equipment there. So I was in Germany for that. Then after Germany, went to back to Fort Sill for some more training and class. Just for more training at Fort Bliss, Fort Sill. And then from Fort Sill, we went to, to Fort Bliss, Command and General Staff College in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. I was a major at that time. And then from there, I went to Vietnam for a year. I promoted to Lieutenant Colonel along the way, and I commanded an artillery battalion in Vietnam. I left Vietnam, went to the Pentagon, and I skipped one step there. I also was sent to University of Arizona, where I got a master's degree in mechanical engineering 9 years after I graduated from West Point. And then when I got to the Pentagon, I was assigned to the Office of Chief of Research and Development. And then from there, I was assigned as one of the military assistants to the Undersecretary of the Army. But then to another school for seniors and selected, both officers and civilians, to the Industrial College of the Armed Forces. And by the way, while I was at Leavenworth, or the Command and General Staff College, one of my classmates was Colin Powell. And we were there at the same time. And so I didn't really get to know him that well because of the way they had us sectioned off. He was in another group at the college at the same time, so we didn't see each other that much, but we were there at the same time. And then after, back to the Pentagon, but then from there to the Industrial College of the Armed Forces, where there was a school for senior officers as well as civilians, where they studied the resources and that kind of thing for other countries. And it broke us up into teams, and we would visit these countries. And that was quite an experience. And then back to Fort Sill. And as at that time, as a full colonel, and went to Fort Sill, and then because of my wife, my son, we had a special needs son, and there's a lot of history there.
I want to come back to that. But let me finish the military side first, and then we'll come back to that because I think that deserves its own discussion. And what I wanted to point out to people is this kind of moving around is it's hard on the military member, it's hard on the family, but it's not unusual, and it's full of interesting new opportunities. And I want to back you up to Germany. You went to, when you got assigned to Germany, it gave you and the family an opportunity to travel and see Europe, and you went to Garmisch-Partenkirchen and Ober-Ammergau, which even today are highly visited, well, maybe not today in the pandemic world, but are highly visited sites by U.S. military. I know my wife and I went to both of them when she was over at the NATO school. It gave you a chance to go to Paris. But you have to be, again, willing to accept those kind of random opportunities that exist and really take advantage of it. And it sounded like that was your philosophy. Was that the way you went after it, Colonel?
Yes, exactly. I welcome that kind of the transitioning. Going to the Industrial College of the Armed Forces was a terrific opportunity to do exactly there. I went to Africa with a team there, and we were there for 3 weeks to study resource management within those countries. And yes, while we were in Germany, We did travel around. We did go. You mentioned the Passion Play. That every 10 years, that's a very rich program that they have every 10 years. And we were fortunate enough to be at Oberammergau at that time. And so we got to Brussels for the World's Fair that was occurring during that rough time. But and the advantage of being in Europe at that time, at any time, is Europe is relatively small when you think in terms of ground to cover as we measured with the United States. We could go from one end of Germany to the other in one day, as far as the travel time is concerned. So anyway, it was quite an experience and Germany. So I talk about Germany. Our mission was unusual and different there, but we were in the middle of the Cold War, and we had to protect the border between us in East Germany. That was our mission.
There's another aspect of military life I want you to talk about, because I suspect this was somewhat surprising to your family and friends back in the States, but also I think today people worry about this as, well, if my son or daughter goes into the military, they're not going to have any friends. And your book is really replete with talking about individual, and generally couples, an army officer and a wife at that time, and the friendships that get formed among army wives and friends that makes these multiple moves and deployments and things bearable. But that was really strong in your experience, wasn't it, Colonel?
Absolutely. Very, very, very strong. We had lifetime friendships. Of course, we lose track of over time, but with people that we had never met, and they, for the most part, were white couples, otherwise. And it was interesting because the experience for them was just as different than as the experience for us, and we learned a lot from each other, and we realized that yes, there's some bad apples out there in the military, and barriers of all kinds, the racial barriers, but there are also some good people, and we cherished the time we spent with some of those folks.
As you can see, Cliff Worthy is a real gentleman, and it was a pleasure to talk to him. We went on for another half hour, and you can hear the whole thing at veteransradio.net. Go to our podcast, and you'll find the full Cliff Worthy interview. I want to take a moment here, take a quick break before we go to the next interview, and recognize our VSO sponsors, Vietnam Veterans of America, Charles S. Kettle Chapter 310 in Ann Arbor, Michigan, VFW Post 423 in Ann Arbor, and American Legion Post 46, also in Ann Arbor. We can't do what we do without their support. And we also have, as a advertiser, the VA Ann Arbor Healthcare System. Again, can't do what we do without the VA's support. And they also provide us regular guests to talk about what's new at VA in the healthcare area, and specifically at the Ann Arbor Healthcare System, which will soon be renamed for Medal of Honor recipient Charles S. Kettles. So let's move on to our discussion with Navy veteran Erica Robertson. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Erica Robertson. Erica's a Navy veteran, which is what we're going to focus on today. But she's a pretty impressive lady, so I want to give you some background here. But before we start, Erica, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, thank you, Jim. It's great to be here.
Erica is a Detroit, Michigan native. She did some moving around with her mother and family and spent a little time in Texas as a kid, did her Navy stint, came back and picked up a bachelor's degree from the University of Michigan, and then went on and got her MBA from the University of Michigan in 2009. She's currently working on her doctoral degree from Vanderbilt in the School of Education. She was in the Navy, I think, from 1994 to 1997, if I've got that right.
That's correct.
She's the founder of something called Education at Scale, a national nonprofit organization focused on policy and research, and recently has started a publishing company called Little Black Girl Adventures, and published a book we're going to talk a little bit about. She's, after her time at the University of Michigan, she's worked for some pretty impressive private sector employers before becoming what I would call a K-12 education crusader and change agent. She's worked for folks like Accenture and Nike in Europe, actually, Western Europe, Detroit Children's Fund, and some other nonprofit. So she's had a big portfolio over time of different things, and you can sort of see how life has changed, and she's focusing on education here. But I had the opportunity, Erica, as I mentioned to you, to read your book, The Adventures of a Little Black Girl, Black Detroit Girl Homecoming, which was just published. Tell us what the genesis of that was.
Well, thank you for that generous introduction, Jim. So The Adventures of a Little Black Detroit Girl really is my story. And I did publish it as a fiction young adult novel. I did change a few names, et cetera. But the genesis really, was really my journey from when I was just a little Black Detroit girl, growing up on the east side of Detroit, to now being a, grown Detroit woman coming back to the city, and my journey in between, but specifically focused on my life between 10 and 21, which was a very challenging time for me. And I wanted to, being in education now, I wanted to contribute to some of the bigger issues in education that are important to me. And one is, trauma, resiliency, and healing of our young people. And I wanted to, as a way to enter that conversation, I wanted to share my story of trauma, my story of healing, my story of resiliency, as a way to get into the conversation and as a platform for young people to know that it's okay to talk about the hard parts of their life. And it's actually healing to talk about the hard parts of your life and also to reshape your own personal narrative. So you may have a hard start, but you can use those challenges. You can use that resiliency to create whatever type of life you want. And I wanted this book to be an example and an inspiration to young people.
Well, you say it's for young people, which it certainly is, and it's written in a way that you could give it to your kids or your grandkids or your niece or nephew, and it'd be an easy read. It's very candid. It really talks about issues you often don't find talked about, so I think it's a great read. And in reading it, and knowing a little bit of your backstory from some friends of ours, you mention how in those challenging years from 10 to 21, became a mother at 18, that your the baby's daddy ended up in prison shortly thereafter, and you sort of had to reevaluate your life and think about how do I move forward from where I'm at, and it took you to joining at 19 the United States Navy. And there's a few references in the book to your Navy experiences, and that's what we want to talk to our veteran radio listeners today about, Erica, is tell us why the Navy, and tell us about those initial experiences of being in the Navy in the mid-1990s.
Yeah, so I have actually a funny story that I didn't capture in my book of how I ended up in the Navy, because I actually was ready to go and all set to go to the Air Force like my mother. But what happened, so if I take you back a little bit, was, like you mentioned, I was pregnant in high school and to my high school sweetheart. And after I graduated from high school, kind of working some part-time, jobs, at Kentucky Fried Chicken, at the drugstore, and he was working at the gas station. And, I always had, even from when I was younger, just had big dreams. And because I did run away from home at 14, and because there were so many challenges, I kind of had forgotten about my dreams and what I wanted to do. But, as you read in the story, Jim, I was my passion was reignited when I had met someone that had been very important, that played a very important role in my life. And I had decided at 18 that I wanted to, revisit the dreams that I had, and I had to figure out how to do that in you know, in light of, you know, me having a young daughter and a boyfriend. So I actually, you know, one day I came home from work and I was talking to Anthony, that was Chloe, my daughter, you know, her name is Zoe in the book, but the father, and I said, hey, we got to get out of here. And I said, I have a plan. I said, I want to join the military like my mom did. Get us out of here. And he was in college at the time. He was in community college. I said, you can finish college and I'll work and you make sure we have food on the table. And then when you finish college, I'll go to school because I'll get the GI Bill. And then, you know, you can make sure that we have food on the table. And so he said, OK, that sounds like a plan. And so we decided to get married. I said, hey, we got to get married to do this. And we decided to get married. And like you mentioned in the book, Jim, 8 days after we got married, I was out visiting friends or family with my daughter. And I got a phone call that Tony had gotten into some trouble. He had taken somebody's life and he had went to jail. And I had already enlisted in the Air Force. I was ready to go. I was 2 weeks out from the Air Force. But I wanted to get out right away. And part of the reason, and I don't even know if I can say this now, Jim, but part of the reason, you know, I wanted to move fast because I didn't know if, you know, the Air Force found out that, you know, I had a husband that went to jail, if I was still going to be able to go. And that was my only way out. So I was like, let me get out of here as quick as I can so I can have a chance. And so I remember going to see my recruiter. There was a couple pieces of paperwork or some stuff that he needed. And I was waiting for him. And the Navy recruiter was actually there. And he was like, hey, who are you waiting for? And I told him, you know, and he was like, well, hey, have you heard about the Navy? And I said, can I leave tomorrow? He was like, yes. I'm like, okay, sign me up. And so literally then I just switched from going to the Air Force to going to the Navy because I was able to leave that week.
Oh, that little part of the story is not in the book. Very interesting.
I know. And so that was the why. That was the why.
Okay. Now I also want to make you talk about something else you referenced that didn't get any development. Because when everybody who's taken the oath ends up in boot camp somewhere. And I don't know anybody who thinks it's a pleasant experience. It's just part of the process, you know. And you talk about a particular petty officer in boot camp that, you know, maybe being helpful is too kind a word, but talk about that experience at that time for you.
Yeah. And you know what? I actually, Jim, would say helpful looking back. Now, going through it, I wouldn't say helpful. But, you know, looking back as a mature adult, it absolutely was helpful. It was actually transformational for me, which is why she's mentioned in the book. But, you know, going in, you know, I was just turning 19. I don't think I was 19 yet. And being, you know, a very independent spirit. I mentioned that I had ran away from home at 14. So I had been out and about on my own, making my own decisions, making my own rules. And, you know, I was already a fireball before I even left home. And so coming into the, you know, military where now you have to do as you're told, there's a certain way that they talk to you. There's certain behavior and etiquette that's expected. That was very new for me. Now, it wasn't new as far as discipline and structure because my mother was in the Air Force and my stepfather was in the Air Force. So I was used to that, you know, level of discipline, but not to the level as an adult that what you're required to do in boot camp. And so long story short, I used to get in trouble for everything from, you know, shoot, my petty officer used to say, hey, Erica, you know, you need to go to the back of the marching line. You shouldn't be shaking your butt at the, you know, front of the line to, you know, putting my hands on my hips and talking back to another company commander. And so I did it not because I wanted to act out, but because that was just, you know, who I was. And the Navy and the military in general, they get rid of that. They want you to act, walk, talk like a soldier. And that just wasn't who I was at that point in my life. But she did see something in me, you know, that kept pushing. And I don't just say me, because I think one of the special things about company commanders and folks that teach and lead in the military is they know that the young people that come through, you know, they know for the most part, especially if you're enlisted, you know, you're there because that's your only way out in a lot of cases. And so they're not there to kick you out. They're there to really try to figure out how they can help you become an excellent soldier or excellent seaman. And so, you know, she actually poured into me. There was a few times where I was actually on the cusp of getting kicked out of boot camp for, you know, insubordinate behavior. And she went to bat for me every time. And over the course of, I think it was 12 weeks or 14 weeks, you know, I went from this, you know, kind of silly, you know, insubordinate young girl to a, you know, I would say now, and what she said is an exemplar of what, you know, that type of discipline and transformation can do for you.
And you come to that, you know, change, if you will, reshaping your own narrative, to use your language, over this 3-month period. But you come to that with, if you will, all the baggage that you were getting away from. And in your instance, you know, there had been an abusive family relationship, that both to your older sister and to your younger brother, yourself, to having a baby as an 18-year-old. I mean, you brought to boot camp, if you will, a whole lot of baggage, didn't you?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And part of, you know, the great thing, and I didn't know this, but it was definitely a blessing, Jim, is, you know, in the military, and you don't know this, I certainly didn't going in, I saw it as a way out. I was like, I'm just going to get out of here. This is a way out. I can pay for college. That was kind of where it was for me. But once you get in, you start learning of all the other supports and benefits there is in being in the military. And one of the things that I learned about quickly when I got there was they had, you know, you could see a therapist, a counselor, that was part of the package for free. And, you know, not even a couple of weeks after I got out of boot camp and got to my duty station in Groton, Connecticut, I remember going to see a psychologist. And she asked me, she says, well, Erica, you know, what brings you in here? And Seaman Robertson, what brings you in here? And I said, hey, I don't want to be like my mother when I grow up. So I knew that there was something wrong with me. I knew, and I'm not going to say wrong with me, but I knew I had a lot of baggage. I knew I had a lot of emotions. I knew I had a lot of feelings that I needed to unpack and talk to someone. And being a young mom, I knew that I had to do it for my daughter, because I didn't want to have her grow up in a household similar to what I grew up in. I wanted to be a better version of my mother. And so it was through that introduction and that free counseling, I got, I received counseling my entire tour in Connecticut. And then 15 years after I left the military, because it was a very healing opportunity for me.
Well, and you point that out in the book, and you actually give this Navy therapist some kudos for saying, you know, this helped me move forward on the right path. And obviously it must have been advantageous at the time that you were doing the counseling. You could see the benefit of it. You weren't being denigrated for it. Your performance reviews weren't being impacted by it. It must have fit right in with what you were doing at your duty station.
Absolutely. You know, and the thing is, when you're that young and you have in what we call trauma, right? And that's what the book is really about. When you experience a lot of trauma, a few things happen. And one of the biggest things that happens is it diminishes your self-worth. And, you know, that counselor really helped me. You know, I started going to, you know, community college while I was in the Navy, right? And started dreaming about where I wanted to go after that. So it really was a very beneficial experience. And of course, these things are confidential. So even within your, you know, your company or your department in the Navy, folks don't have to know that you're seeing someone. It's a very confidential, very safe, and very freeing environment.
Well, I think at times people don't understand how much the military is there to support its members. As you pointed out, in boot camp, they're not looking to kick you out. They're trying to mold you, if you will, to reshape you into what is an ideal soldier or seaman. They're trying to give you medical and healthcare services, again, for that same purpose. But I think oftentimes today, whether it's kids thinking about joining the military or their parents and support structure, their family thinking about their kid going into the military, they don't necessarily see all the advantages, do they?
Yeah, they don't. And part of it is just the unknowing, you know, especially if you're – if you have two scenarios, one, you're a kid, you're trying to figure out where you're going. You may or may not have the guidance, you know, of a parent who has the knowledge. And so, you know, all you know is, you know, there's a military, there's a chance that you may or may not go to war. And, you know, you just don't have that information.
Well, I want to talk about your particular job or MOS in the military, because I don't mm-hmm. know that I've ever talked to somebody who was a journalist and in the military as an enlisted person and who had her own biweekly column called Ask Erica. So for the for this fireball 19-year-old kid out of Detroit, getting into public affairs and getting into writing like this probably was turned out to be kind of a dream job.
It was a dream job. It was cool, and I have to say I was the envy of most. And even in boot camp, and again, you know, I have to give some grace to God because I do believe that He's been the author of my story as well. But even in boot camp, you know, you get to, you know, you in the Navy, and I'm not sure how it is in the other branches, but at the end of a certain amount of training, you have to work. And most folks go to the galley or they go to the master at arms, which is like the brig. But I was chosen to go to the public affairs office in boot camp. I think it's 2 or 3 weeks. And I really liked it. And so just getting that exposure in boot camp, when I did get to my my duty station in Connecticut, you know, you could think about what you want to do. And the thing about the Navy is if you could choose to go to like an A school, but if you go to an A school, which is you actually learn a trade, you go through the classes, you go through the curriculum, they add on. So 3 years is the minimum you have to serve. But then if you go to an A school, depending on what type of job it is, you need to stay an extra two, 3 years. But I did apprentice under my chief petty officer over public affairs. You know, for a period of time, I want to say it was 10 or 12 months, could have been longer. And I studied both journalism and photography. So after, you know, that period of apprenticeship and me passing the test, I officially became a journalist and photographer. And I did work for the Navy paper, The Dolphin. And I learned how to write, very concise, information. And more importantly, as a photographer, you know, I had a chance to kind of go out and interact with just a bunch of different people. I love interacting with people. And I actually had a car. I didn't know at the time, but I actually had a company car. So I was one of the few enlisted men that had a car that I could drive around and go to the different venues to write my story and take pictures. So it was an absolutely amazing experience for me.
Well, let me bring this full circle before we run out of time, because I want to think about this 19 or 20 year old fireball from Detroit who becomes this journalist writing stories. And today I'm talking to that same Erica Robertson, who not only has published her own book, she's now owner of a publishing company. Again, talk about dreaming big, from I'm going to write some articles for the Dolphin to I'm going to own a publishing company. I'm pretty impressed on the full circle.
Yeah. You know, when you said it like that, Jim, I just got goosebumps because you're right. My life has, come full circle. And, you know, I do believe in God, and in the Bible, it says nothing wasted. And I believe all these experiences, whether they're challenging or whether they're exciting, whether they're fun, or whether they're, you know, they're sad, they all work together, you know, to create whatever future you want to create if you allow it. And I just believe that all the different experiences that I've had, and they did start with the military. I believe I was given, you know, preferential treatment getting into University of Michigan, you know, because I was a veteran. I believe that, in certain jobs that I went to, I was given preferential treatment because people really saw that as a value add. And so I just think, you know, starting off with that, you know, the discipline and then also the pedigree that you carry with you for the rest of your life as a veteran really, really does, has been really helpful to me. And using all the different resources that the Navy provided me, from, you know, the GI Bill to, you know, my VA loans, really has, you know, helped me build a life that that's lacking nothing.
Tell folks now how they can find the book, find out what you're doing in the educational field, and keep track of Erica Robertson.
Yes. So the book, it released in July, so it is available on my website. And my website is www.littleblackdetroitgirl.com. And what I will add to that is, and I'll give it again, www.littleblackdetroitgirl.com, is, you know, this book is just the first of what I'm trying to build. And to your point earlier, Jim, is I really do want to build a publishing empire that can really empower little young, you know, boys and girls. And I have boys and girls of color, but it's all little boys and girls to be bold enough and brave enough and, you know, to share their story, to own their story and to reshape their story any way they want to. So the book is just one of several things that I have in the pipeline for young people. We also have curriculum that we have created for schools, for middle school, high school, and college, as well as virtual book clubs to have a platform for young people to learn more about resiliency and how to build it in their lives. So a lot's going on. So if you go on the website, you can sign up to learn more about everything we have going on.
Both of these veterans, Erica Robertson and Colonel Cliff Worthy, are really impressive. And all of us who have served have to be glad to be affiliated with such great people. So thanks for listening to Veterans Radio. You can find all more at veteransradio.net. You can find their full podcast interviews that we have up if you want to hear the rest of the story. We really appreciate you tuning in and continue to follow what we're doing on Veterans Radio. You can always send us an email at jim@veteransradio.net or my partner dale@veteransradio.net to give us some story ideas. Again, thanks for tuning in to Veterans Radio, and until next time, you are dismissed.